We all can identify salty, bitter, sweet, and sour, but did you know there's a fifth taste? It was only recently discovered by the scientific community, and yet it was recognized over a century ago by the French chef Auguste Escoffier. It's called umami, and joining me now to discuss it are Ruth Reichel, editor-in-chief of Gourmet Magazine, who visits us once a month to talk about food-related things, along with Jonah Lehrer, who is the editor of Seed Magazine and the author of a book called Proust Was a Neuroscientist. I'm very pleased to welcome them to the show. Hi.
Hi. Hi.
Now, we said that Escoffier discovered it in the scientific community, but it has a Japanese name. So a Japanese scientist discovered it, Jonah?
Well, a Japanese chemist named Kikuna Ikeda in 1907 was the first one to isolate the ingredient, the amino acid, which represents the taste of umami, this taste of protein.
Well, you said 1907?
In 1907, he was eating a bowl of dashi, which is a Japanese broth made of dried kelp. And Kikuna Ikeda's revelation was that this broth didn't taste like any of the four classic tastes. It didn't taste sweet, sour, salty, or bitter. He called this taste the taste of deliciousness. He said this broth was the taste of deliciousness or the taste of umami.
But that was 100 years ago. Why are we just starting to hear about umami now?
Well, for most of the 20th century, science ignored the research of Kikuna Ikeda. They thought the tongue had been solved. They thought there were these four classic tastes, sweet, sour, salty, and bitter, and they'd mapped these four tastes to different parts of the tongue, so sweet was in front, bitter in back, and sour and salty were on the sides of the tongue, and there was no room left on the tongue for this taste of protein, this taste of umami.
And the taste and the tongue actually are through the taste buds, or do we really have taste buds?
Yeah, in the year 2000, scientists at UCSD isolated a taste receptor which responds to the taste of protein, which responds to this amino acid glutamate, which we now know is the taste of umami.
In the 19th century, they actually discovered the taste buds by looking at tongues under a microscope. But we've been stuck with the four primary tastes because of Aristotle. He just messed up everything.
It goes back to Democritus and Aristotle. And if you pick up a textbook, you'll still see references to the four classic taste sensations.
Well, I have to tell you, Ruth, all of my life I believe there were four tastes, and I got along just fine. Did you feel frustrated at times? Did you sense that there might have been a fifth one?
Well, I mean, actually, it's wrong to think that there are five tastes. In fact, as they're mapping the human genome, they're starting to discover that there may be 30 or 40.
And I'm going to have to learn all those Japanese words.
They're not all Japanese. And they're also finding that we have taste buds all over our mouths. So just thinking about your tongue as the, you know, only arbiter of taste is wrong as well. It's fascinating to me that we respond later to taste than to, for instance, sight and so forth. And we have been extremely slow to make scientific discoveries. I mean, the idea that it took until, you know, the mapping of the human genome for us to discover things about the way we taste is so strange to me.
Yeah, well, I always thought there were shadings. I mean, it was more like paint, you know, like there are many different yellows. Anyone who's tasted honey knows it's not just sweet. There's a wide range of sweets. But are people starting to put names to those different sweets?
They are starting now. I mean, science, and I think largely because there's money in it, so food scientists are spending a lot of time trying to find out exactly what it is that we taste and, you know, how many receptors there are and how they can play with those receptors, how they can turn one off or, turn another one on. But, you know, having absolutely identified that umami is a real thing, that we respond to glutamates.
Well, milk doesn't fit into any of the four. It's not salty, bitter, sweet, and sour, but is it umami?
Milk?
Yeah.
Yes. Milk is definitely very high in glutamate. And as milk is aged and becomes a hard cheese, it also increases in glutamic acid, which is the free form of glutamate, which is the form of glutamate that the tongue can taste. So Parmesan cheese, Roquefort cheese, these are things that are very, very high in glutamate. Very high umami.
It's interesting that that Democritus, who thought about atoms, was one of the first people to try to categorize the science of taste.
Yeah, I mean, you can see in the ancient Greeks, they really wanted to understand taste sensations and to break them down into discrete categories. And it's kind of strange that these four categories, which we inherited, lasted for so long. And now, of course, we're realizing that those were just the beginning of the world of taste, and that, in fact, most of what we consider taste is actually smell. So as you pointed out, Aristotle wasn't exactly right.
Well, Ruth and I participated in a test on the air. In fact, I won a James Beard Award because of it. Thank you. With Danielle and a woman from the Manel Institute, in which we put nose clips on and tasted very powerfully flavored things and couldn't taste them until we took the nose clips off.
It was, you know, it's one of those things that you've always heard and you never quite believe. And then when it really happened, you're stunned.
Because they were so powerful in some cases, and I could taste just a faint trace of something, but not identify it.
I mean, the most astonishing one were these, like, really sort of awful licorice jelly beans, and you couldn't taste anything, and you took this clip off, and this rush of flavor, not very pleasant flavor in my opinion, went racing through your mouth.
Well, actually, there's a lesson there, don't you think, Ruth? There are places you can go to eat where you're just hungry and you have no choice in the matter, where you should bring a nose clip.
Absolutely.
My guests are Ruth Reichel, the editor-in-chief of Gourmet Magazine, and Jonah Lehrer, who has written Proust Was a Neuroscientist. We're talking about umami on our show today. This is the Leonard Lopez Show on WNYC, WNYC.org. I mentioned Auguste Escoffier. Now, he didn't call it umami, obviously, but he sure was interested in those other flavors, the great French chef.
Actually, Jonah has an absolutely wonderful description of Escoffier going towards umami without really understanding that he was doing it, in making this stock.
Veal stock.
Yes, that was the centerpiece of Escoffier's cuisine.
Had no one made a veal stock before him?
Oh, of course, people had made stocks and boiled beef and made meat broths. But Escoffier insisted that stocks were the centerpiece of French food. He really made it the foundation of fancy French cuisine.
And
he says in the very first page of his cookbook, if you've got a good stock, cooking's easy. If you've got a bad stock, you're wasting your time and you shouldn't be in the kitchen.
Well, I don't think there are that many people, home cooks today, who cook with stocks. They may have some cans of chicken broth in the closet, or maybe even a beef broth, but not a veal stock.
I'm not sure Escoffier would approve, but it's okay.
And he would probably say that what they're cooking isn't food.
So when you, and what about when you're putting together a magazine, Ruth? Do you worry about whether a recipe might require a good veal stock? Because so many, very few people are going to make them.
Not only a good veal stock, I have to say that we often worry and spend a lot of time, you know, testing with various kinds of canned broths, knowing that even in something as simple as a risotto, I mean, the difference between making that with, you know, a real stock, a chicken stock, and something from a can, I mean, the difference is astonishing.
And chefs understand this. I recently saw Jacques Pepin do a little demonstration, and he said that he just takes all the stuff that I throw in the garbage, and he puts them in a bowl, and then he puts them in the freezer. And when the time comes to make a stock, he pulls them out and throws them in with all the other little, whether it's the tips of the chicken wings or whatever it is, all those vegetable things, the ends of the carrots and the like. And he says it makes a great stock, and it doesn't cost anything, really, because you've already used the other part of the thing for another meal.
And it's very hard to train yourself to do this, too. I mean, you know, one of the things that drives me crazy is that people throw away the rind of a Parmesan cheese, which is the
I
most...
I chew on it.
You chew on it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I chew on it. Like it's better than that licorice we had.
But, you know, it's absolutely wonderful thrown into a stock. Mm-hmm. It changes the taste of any soup. And, again, there it is, umami.
Yeah, it definitely gets back to umami. And that thing is the genius of stock, is that Escoffier took all the things that chefs used to throw out and boiled it in water for 12 hours. That's what I understand as a home cook, that it's often difficult because it takes a while to make a stock and you have to clarify it. And it's definitely a labor-intensive process.
And a lot of people don't want to have veal under any circumstances if you want to follow Escoffier.
Yeah, it's tough to find, a massive veal bones to, if you really want to replicate Escoffier's recipes.
Well, Escoffier was also interested in science, wasn't he?
Well, he had a complicated relationship with science. He called chefs intuitive chemists, and yet he pretty much rejected the taste science of his day, which said broccoli was bad for you and that tripe was health food. So he definitely kind of took what he wanted from the science of his day. But he told chefs, he said, if you want to understand the tongue, pay attention to your tongue, listen to your tongue, trust your tongue, pay attention to your own experience, taste and taste again, and that's how you'll figure out how the tongue works.
The French didn't like broccoli in those days?
They thought it wasn't good for digestion. So there's a story with nutritionism.
So what we have is scientists being wrong. And there's often been tension between scientists and cooks throughout history, hasn't there?
My sense is that there has been tension between scientists and everyone.
For example, we were told when I was a kid that all those frozen foods and those frozen TV dinners and the like were the result of the most advanced science.
Yes, and isn't that sad?
Yeah. Well, what about today? There are any number of chefs who are going to science as guideposts for inventing recipes. Wiley Dufresne, Ferran Adrià, Heston Blumenthal. I just was speaking with James Peterson. He said, well, that doesn't appeal to him. He would prefer just to take the ingredients and get the most flavor out of them that he can. But there are a lot of people very excited about their food.
Well, I think it's a really interesting time. I mean, the truth is that we, meaning human beings, have been essentially cooking the same way since, man first discovered fire. And the idea that we have people, wandering around on the moon, but we're still cooking like cavemen is sort of silly. And, I think there's a really wonderful meeting place now where scientists and chefs are interested in what each other are doing, which is a little bit what your book is about.
Well, in a sense, I think molecular gastronomy, the chefs we've been talking about, they are a model for different cultures coming together. You have artists and scientists who are coming together to create something that's never been done before. I mean, I think a lot of the time their food is very interesting. Having worked in a science lab, it's sometimes unsettling to see these ingredients I associated with molecular biology and toxic experiments being sprinkled on and turned into delicious food, these weird kinds of agar and stuff. But that said, I think sometimes their creation, the food speaks for itself.
In fact, talking about agar, Ruth, one of your favorite chefs, Grant Achatz of Alinea in Chicago, uses agar. This is something that was best known for growing bacteria in Petri dishes.
Well, it's also in most ice cream. It's a chemical, but it's a chemical that food scientists found a long time ago was very useful to them. And now you have really good chefs saying, well, if it's good for industry, what can we do with it that will make our food better? And I'm fascinated by chefs like Grant and Adrià and Wiley Dufresne who are sort of taking the food apart and trying to recombine it in interesting ways. And it's what you would expect. I mean, you would think that people would embrace this. I mean, this is essentially what Escoffier did, right? He said, let me take what is available to me and recombine it. So now you have, we're in the 21st century. We know a lot more than we knew in the days of Escoffier. And you have chefs who are saying, let me take this apart. Now we have the ability to separate the molecules and serve food that is in a completely different form. So let me get the taste out of something and let me give you air that's flavored with carrot.
Johnny, you say that deglazing was the secret to Escoffier's success. Was that cutting-edge science at the time?
That wasn't cutting-edge science. That was just Escoffier's intuition. Deglazing is it's a very simple process. What you do is you take a piece of protein, a chicken breast, a filet mignon, a piece of fish, and you put in a pan, none of this non-stick stuff, and you burn the meat, you burn the protein, and you get all those burned bits of protein stuck to the bottom of the pan, and then you cook, and then you finish cooking a piece of protein, and then you take your stock, the stock you've been simmering for 12 hours, and you add that to the pan, and then take your wooden spoon and scrape up all those burned bits of protein, and that's the process of deglazing. And that's another one of the foundations of Escoffier's recipes. He returns to this process again and again to create his pan sauces. And they are very rich in those burned bits of protein, which is essentially unrivaled glutamate, this amino acid, which is the foundation of umami.
So we're back to umami.
We're back to umami when you talk about deglazing.
And I guess nobody thought about asparagus when they were talking about the four flavor groups, for example, or Parmesan cheese. There's so many things that don't fit. Excuse me?
Or fish sauce. Why do so many cuisines have fish sauces? You know, fish sauce is very dense in glutamate. It's very dense in umami. It's rotten fish. It's rotten anchovies.
Well, that's an Asian taste, and not everyone outside of Asia loves those fish sauces. I guess it's an acquired taste. I happen to love it.
But the Italians have salted anchovies, and the ancient Romans had garum. Just recurring flavor. People crave this
rotting.
This rotting flavor, the taste of rot, in a sense.
So umami is the fifth and rotting is the sixth.
Well, it's sort of stunning when you go through the list of foods that are really high in glutamates. It's sort of everything that we all love.
Yeah.
It's tomatoes, it's cheese, it's...
Even Marmite, that British yeast extract spread, which I think unless you've been raised on, it's a very tough food to enjoy, but that's like a...
I lived in England for a year. I never got past that.
But that's like an umami speedball. That's the world's densest the densest amount of, you know, glutamate you can fit in a processed food product, essentially. It's pure yeast extract. And that's just free glutamate.
We'll continue our conversation, but also if for people who are interested in learning more about umami, there's actually an umami festival that begins this Thursday, I think it is. What is today?
Today is Tuesday.
No, I mean, what day is it, the 5th, the 6th? Anyway, the 8th of April, and it runs through the 18th.
I think that's today.
Oh, today.
Why are we doing umami today?
I thought it was because it was near Umami's Day. Running today through the 18th at 20 Green Street. And if you want more information, you can go to their website, Umami Festival. That's UMAMI, umamifestival.com. And we will be posting it on our website as well. We're also taking a little break, but we will be back with Jonah Lehrer, editor of Seed Magazine, author of Proust Was a Neuroscientist, which is published by Houghton Mifflin, and Ruth Reichel, who's editor-in-chief of Gourmet Magazine and who has too many books for me to list, and another one in the works?
Yes.
And we'll talk about that sometime soon. Every so often, I do things outside of the station. Tonight, I'll be speaking with two of our finest contemporary novelists, Claire Massoud and Carol Phillips. That's at 7 p.m. at Queen's College. For more information, you can visit www.qc.edu/readings. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. We're also heard on satellite. And today, on the first day of the Umami Festival here in New York at 20 Green Street, we're talking about umami with Ruth Reichel, editor-in-chief of Gourmet Magazine, and Jonah Lehrer, who has written a book called Proust Was a Neuroscientist, which deals a lot with umami. Inspired to write the book because of umami?
I've got a chapter on Auguste Escoffier, who I anticipated this discovery, this very recent scientific discovery of the umami receptor. And the book was in part inspired by, I worked in several kitchens, and I really appreciated grew to appreciate the kind of cultural wisdom that chefs had learned and passed down. When you first start working in a kitchen, there are all these, you know, seemingly idiosyncratic rules on how to cut an onion, or how to chop a carrot for this dish or this dish. And gradually over time, you learn to appreciate that you know, there's a real logic behind that chefs are, in a sense, intuitive chemists.
But it is interesting that Escoffier and Professor Kikune Ikeda of Tokyo Imperial University both started thinking about other tastes around the same time. Is that and very far apart? I doubt that Ikeda even knew that there was a man named Escoffier, and vice versa.
I mean, they definitely were both, I think, rebelling against this idea that there were just four taste sensations. Escoffier obviously wasn't talking about umami or even thinking about amino acids or glutamate. But I think he realized that to simply talk about food in terms of sweet, sour, salty, and bitter was to miss out on what made food so interesting to him, was to miss out on the real things that made food delicious.
And it's interesting that Ikeda's idea, despite the fact that we all can recognize these other tastes, were totally ignored for almost 100 years. It wasn't until the year 2000 that scientists at the University of Miami identified receptors on the tongue with no purpose other than to recognize the presence of glutamate?
This was definitely a case of science playing catch-up. And it was also a case of science even playing catch-up with food science. You know, you had food companies realize that MSG, Shikeda helped invent, that's monosodium glutamate, and he was the one who combined glutamate to a salt to make MSG. Food companies have been putting MSG in food for most of the 20th century, so they clearly realized that glutamate was something we could taste. It was just science didn't quite realize it.
And many people feel that MSG has gotten a bad rap recently. A few people have gotten lightheaded, I guess, when it's been overused.
The science on that is very murky. The Chinese food syndrome, the Chinese food migraine syndrome. Glutamate is also a neurotransmitter. It's a chemical used by your brain cells to communicate with each other. So I think when people first thought about MSG, they thought maybe it would cross the blood-brain barrier and cause changes in the brain. So I imagine there was some initial confusion over how MSG might work. But lots of people have looked for connections and not found any.
And I've spoken to any number of Chinese chefs who say, well, I don't use a lot of it, but I can't imagine not using it because it does enhance the flavor of the food.
I know that the science on it says that the MSG effect doesn't exist. I also know that if there is a lot of MSG in things, I do get this tightness in my head. And it's like it's a physical thing that happens. I am convinced that they are going to discover at some point that in certain concentrations, it does have an effect on some people.
Mm. Well, I've talked to some scientists, too, who say, well, because glutamate is the taste receptor for glutamate on your tongue is simply a modified version of the neurotransmitter receptor in your brain, that it's very easy to imagine how it would happen. So they also, you know, some of them doubt these studies saying that there's no link at all. But I think the question is still very open. No one knows how it works or if it does.
Wasn't there a flavor enhancer called Adolf's when I was a kid that was pretty much MSG as well?
MSG's been sold under super seasoning. It's been sold as accent. Now they hide it in food labels, so it's often hidden under autolyzed yeast extract or sodium caseinate. But it's still there in a lot of processed foods.
But it really comes out of fermenting corn glucose. But back to the corn. Everything seems to be coming out of corn these days. Is that weird?
You just need an amino acid. Glutamate's the most prevalent amino acid in life, so it's you know, it can be found anywhere.
Today, an estimated 95,000 metric tons of MSG are sold in North America each year. It's found in pretty much every fast and processed food. So we're living with it whether we want to or not.
Yes, we are.
Ruth, why do you think umami is all the rage now?
Well, I think that chefs have just now that it's actually been identified as a real thing. There was a long time when it was very murky and no one could describe what it was. And now that it's been identified as a real thing, chefs are using it because people love it. You know, this is a way to make food that people really love. And, you know, people like Jean-Georges Van Gerechten say that they are making what they call umami bombs.
What does that mean? Have you tried one?
Well, we eat them all the time. You know, eat a piece of Parmesan cheese, you're eating an umami bomb.
Yeah, or a spoonful of ketchup. Ketchup's very high in umami.
And, you know, once you know that this is a way of seducing people, if you're a chef, you'd be crazy not to pay attention to it. And, you know, if you're a food magazine and you're thinking about how to make food that people like, you would be crazy not to be aware that these are, you know, we crave sugar, but we also crave umami.
And I guess we shouldn't look down on those people who pour the ketchup on their meat because they're just doing umami in the same way that when somebody shaves some Parmesan over pasta,
or
it's just
truffles.
Adding the umami.
Yes.
Truffles are umami?
I believe that they are.
Well, if they're not, they're still really delicious. So I'm going to put them in the umami in the category right now just for the heck of it. Can you imagine doing a gourmet issue devoted to umami?
Yes, I could definitely imagine that. But please don't put that out in the world because somebody else will do it first.
But this is not is this something you've discussed in the magazine?
It's something we've thought about, actually. Yeah. I mean, it's such an exciting concept. And then when you realize that virtually all of the foods that we really love really are high in glutamates, you think, you know, if you want to do an issue about foods we all love, here's a great way to do it.
Well, I gather now that there's a lot of new research and development that is looking into various ways that umami can be put into foods. I would assume that if I were doing some kind of a processed food and wanted to get past the high sodium problem, that I would think along these lines.
Yes, you probably would.
And it's definitely a way of science catching up with folk wisdom. I mean, people have been putting Parmesan rinds in their broths for centuries, and only now, in the 21st century, is science finally, you know, able to explain why exactly we've been adding fish sauce to our pad thai or putting Parmesan rinds in our broths. And it all comes back to this little taste receptor in our mouth.
Yeah, you want to know, you know, why is Caesar salad on every menu in America? It's virtually a vehicle for umami.
Yeah. Mm.
Didn't you train as a chef?
I had the privilege of working in a few restaurant kitchens.
With Cirque, Le Bernardin, and not just, you know, that's not chopped liver.
Oh,
I would love to have chopped liver at Le Cirque sometime.
I was just a lowly prep cook and line cook. But it really was a great training, and you really learn how to cut onions.
Did your love of food bring you to science, or was it the other way around, or were they parallel?
They were pretty simultaneous. I would often have days where I'd work in a kitchen and also a lab, so you definitely appreciate that they shared a common set of manual labors. There's lots of chopping in both. But as I said before, I definitely grew to appreciate that even if chefs couldn't talk about the breakdown of sulfuric acid and, you know, the way to cook an onion, they definitely appreciated how it worked. They definitely knew how it worked, and their recipes reflected that wisdom.
Although we're seeing more and more people questioning the old ideas, you know, if you braise something quickly, it's going to do something, or you should baste it, you shouldn't baste it. Science is really getting more and more involved, even on that level in the kitchen, isn't it?
It is, but
you do that in your test kitchens? You say, well, gee, if we baste this turkey 300 times, is it going to be better than not basting it at all?
Oh, we do those kinds of empirical tests constantly.
That's science.
Get a turkey in every one of our 8 ovens and do something different and see what works best. I mean, we're constantly doing that.
In fact, there's another magazine that's devoted to just rethinking every recipe. Should I mention the name of the competition? Cooks Magazine.
Sure, you can do that. Our executive editor was the editor of that magazine.
In your book, Jonah, Proust was a neuroscientist. You argue that many artists have foretold the scientific future, like Escoffier, for example, or Walt Whitman, or Paul Cézanne. What inspired you to come up with that theory?
I was working in a lab that was studying the chemistry of memory, what happens in your mind when you make a memory. And there's lots of downtime in a science lab. You're always waiting for experiments to finish or, you know, not turkeys to finish cooking, but, you know, gels to run out or something. And so I got in the habit of reading novels while I was waiting for my experiments. And one day I brought in Proust's Swan's Way, the first volume of his epic, and I realized that this novel, which is about one man's memory, it's really an investigation into his memory, had in a sense
based on, by the way, philosophical and scientific thinking of the time.
Absolutely. Proust
Bergson,
Proust was
fascinating.
Yes, absolutely. That this novel, this work of fiction, anticipated many of the experiments I was doing in the lab. And that's where I first started thinking about the wisdom of art and how artists could actually anticipate these things like umami that science will only later discover.
Mm-hmm. And now we stuck with umami and we're going to forget about sugar, salt, and all the rest of that stuff?
Oh, no. We're not going to forget about sugar, salt. We love those too. This just gives us one more tool.
But because I do know people who say, "Oh, the recipe calls for a cup of sugar. I will put in a quarter cup of sugar. Oh, the recipe calls for a tablespoon of salt. I'll put in a teaspoon of salt because these are bad for me." And now we're saying the same thing about MSG. The alternative is what? Bland, totally bland food.
Well, I think as long as we are cooks, you can count on the fact that we're going to be tinkering with the recipes. I mean, I actually think more people tend to throw in extra. You know, if a cup is good, maybe I'll throw in a cup and a quarter. It's the American way.
Do you know what's being offered at the Umami Festival?
I do not.
Neither of you do. Yeah. So we're all going to go there and find out for ourselves. But you're here because the festival, I'm a little dense, so it suddenly dawned on me, April 8th today, the festival begins.
I'm fascinated to find out what it is that they are going to be offering. I'm anticipating lots of delicious things.
Do you think you said that there are many more tastes. Do you think that they are shadings, or do you think that there really are distinct other tastes?
Oh, I think that, if you say a taste is something that you have a receptor for, I think that they are not shadings. They are very distinct chemicals that we, can receive somewhere in our mouths.
For example, the taste of spicy food we now know is responsible because we can taste spicy food because of a receptor called the VR1 receptor, which actually evolved from a heat receptor. So that's why spicy food tastes hot, because it's actually a modified heat receptor, which was designed originally to detect, hot foods.
And now there's a wine glass maker who says that the shape of the wine glass affects the way we taste the wine.
Well, we ran an article debunking that pretty effectively a couple of years ago.
That's actually rooted in this very old theory of these four tastes being on different parts of the tongue, which goes back to the 19th century and has been pretty thoroughly debunked in the 21st century.
Since those glasses are so expensive, you've just saved me a lot of money.
Yes. Well, what we said is that they're very nice to hold and to feel, but the idea that, one is good for Bordeaux and one is good for Chianti is nonsense.
But then again, the placebo effect is a very powerful effect, so perhaps it does make the wine taste better anyways.
But, I think the other thing that we're going to find out, that we are finding out, but intuitively sort of always knew it, is that we taste differently. That, what you taste isn't what I taste.
The same thing as whether you see red differently from the way I see red. But we've run out of time.
Well,
that's one thing that is constant, the clock. I want to thank you so much for being with us. Ruth Reichel, editor-in-chief of Gourmet Magazine. Jonah Lehrer, editor of Seed Magazine. And Arthur Proust was a neuroscientist. It's been a real pleasure. Did you know that there are more species of fish in the Amazon than in the entire Atlantic Ocean? On tomorrow's show, Fabienne Cousteau tells us about the Amazon, its importance to the Earth's ecosystem, and what we can do to save it from destruction. Also, retracing the footsteps of U.S. armed forces in Europe during World War II, Tobias Wolff with his latest short story collection, and your calls to the gurus of how-to, Al and Larry Ubell. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blake Neuschick, Sarah English, and Scott Goldberg. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Dina Mann, Stephanie Hughes, Paula Crossfield, and contributing producer Melissa Waldron-Lehner. Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. We'll see you tomorrow.